Well, good morning, Summit and Wasatch Counties. 8:06 on your Thursday morning. It's September 23rd. I'm Sean Higgins in the KPCW studios in Park City, sitting in for Leslie Thatcher once again. Well, still a little bit chilly this morning in the Wasatch Bank, but it's shaping up to be a gorgeous weekend. On the line with me now with a full forecast, ABC4 meteorologist Thomas Kaboy. Good morning, Thomas.
Good morning, Sean. Happy Thursday or happy Friday Eve to you. Yeah, it's a little chilly out there along the Wasatch Bank, but at least it's not as chilly compared to what we've gotten used to so far this week. So early, a couple days ago, we were talking about freezing temperatures in Park City. You're very far away from that this morning, right now sitting at 49 degrees. The coldest bottle on the Wasatch Back right now looks to be at Heber at 36 degrees. But even Alta sitting at 43. So this morning, definitely a little noticeably warmer compared to earlier this week. So still sweater weather, maybe even a light jacket. But by this afternoon, it's going to be downright comfortable as we'll get a mostly sunny to partly cloudy sky. There will be some times of haze, but not going to see too much in the way of patchy smoke. The daytime high today in Park City climbing to 69 degrees. So very comfortable for this afternoon. A great day to maybe spend some time outside, albeit there might be some moderate air quality. So maybe not the greatest, but also not the worst. And in some of the higher elevation areas, an isolated shower can't be completely ruled out, but I think any rain stays away from Park City for today. But as you travel up to 8,000-9,000 feet, maybe a sprinkle will be a possibility as there's a system that's going to be moving through the state today, moves from north to south. Into tonight, it's a mostly clear sky with temperature in Park City dropping to 44 degrees. And then what the trend is going to be as we move into the upcoming weekend will be a steady warm-up where each morning will be just a little bit warmer and each afternoon will be a little bit warmer. Under a mostly sunny sky. So Friday, that's going to result in a daytime high of 72 degrees with an overnight low Friday night into Saturday morning at 47. And then with high pressure kind of taking control of our weather, we get a high of 74 on Saturday and a high of 75 degrees on Sunday. And as you mentioned, Sean, we're going to see some great weather for this weekend. So if you have any outdoor plans, I think that you're going to like what you're going to find. And for Saturday night and Sunday night, the overnight low will be around 50 degrees both of those nights. As we turn the page into next week, Monday's not going to bring too many changes compared to what we see on Sunday. But a pattern change could be underway for Tuesday and Wednesday of next week. At least models are suggesting that we could see a change in our weather. We'll bring a slight rain chance into the forecast heading into Tuesday with daytime highs continuing in the lower 70s. But then a front might make its way through heading into Wednesday, keeping that slight chance of showers. So Tuesday night, a low of 45 degrees. And then on Wednesday during the afternoon, a high right around 61. So could see a pretty big change by the middle of next week. But we'll make sure we keep you posted on that.
As always, Thomas, thank you so much. Looking forward to some amazing weekend weather. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. You have a great day.
Well, stay tuned. Starting at 8:15, we are going to have Summit County Councilmember Chris Robinson recap yesterday's county council meeting. Jordan Moon will call in to talk about his quest to break the record for running across the country by doing it in 42 days or less. He trained for the feat right here in Park City and is making his way through Utah right now. Rebecca Brenner will talk about her upcoming six-week mindful relaxation course at the Park City Hospital's Live Well Center as well. All that coming up. Starting at 8:15. Taking a look at some local news now. Park City's neighborhood traffic management programs include the Pupil First Streets Project, which uses inexpensive temporary solutions like colorful paint to slow downtown traffic and increase pedestrian safety. KPCW's Carolyn Murray has an update on the seasonal program.
Data shows the People First Streets Project in Prospector has reduced vehicle speeds by 1 mile per hour since it began in June. Park City Active Transportation Manager Austin Taylor said that's less of an impact than they hoped for, but that every little bit helps in terms of reducing accidents. The street painting project on Gold Dust Lane and Sidewinder Drive in the Prospector neighborhood includes a corner that has a restaurant, businesses, a sports club, residential homes, and a daycare. It brought out a half dozen people to paint bold colors in several crosswalks. They also installed flower planters and ballasts to narrow the roadway. Prospector resident Dana Perry lives at the three-way intersection of Gold Dust and Sidewinder. She said the area is not safer for pedestrians because of the project. She thinks speed humps are the answer for slowing cars.
I think we need speed humps. Just flat out. And it's like, they don't even have the curb painted right there. You're supposed to park 30 feet back. Come back here around 5 to 6 o'clock at night when Grubstake's full. Grubstake doesn't have a parking lot. They don't have a parking lot. So everybody has to park on the streets here. And then they don't have the bus stop painted, and they don't have a red curb in front of the stop sign. So people park and block the stop sign and the bus stop right there every night. And so then the bus has to just stop in the middle of the road.
Taylor said the city would not approve speed humps because they impede emergency vehicle response. He added that data shows narrowing streets slow speeds. Perry suggests the intersection could be transformed into a three-way stop, although she does not want a stop sign next to her front yard. She thinks the single stop sign is not adequate for reducing speeds. Taylor's report on the project shows 88% of in-person pedestrian feedback was positive, with people feeling safer walking through the crosswalks. However, online feedback indicated over 90% of respondents did not like the project, with most comments focused on the paint colors and materials used. The project cost the city about $1,800 in supplies. Aspen Springs Homeowners Association President Beth Armstrong worked with nearly 80 homeowners to rally support for a similar crosswalk painting project to address pedestrian safety on Meadows Drive and SR 224. She said pedestrians, bikers, and skiers use the crosswalk year-round to access the McPolin Farm pathways and skier trails.
So it's a heavily used crosswalk. Average speed of people coming up that hill was 40 miles an hour in a 25. And I thought, you know, somebody's going to get hurt because they're turning in and just speeding up there. And there was just the two white lines, so really no real indication that it was a major crosswalk.
Over the period of March 22nd to July 15th, the data for Aspen Springs indicates 70% of vehicles entering the neighborhood at Meadows Drive are exceeding the 25 miles per hour zone, 13 exceed 35 miles per hour, and less than 1% exceed 45 miles per hour. Since the community painted the crosswalk in July, data shows that just under half of vehicles exceeded 25 miles per hour. The city budget for People First Streets is about $20,000 annually. Taylor suggests residents engage with the Neighborhood Traffic Management Program, NTMP, for more permanent traffic calming efforts. Contact Austin Taylor at 435-615-5317 for more information. Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
Well, Summit County is providing $100 in vaccination bonuses to its staff, regardless of whether an employee is being encouraged to get vaccinated or the person is being rewarded for already getting the shot. Rick Bruff has more.
County Council Chair Glenn Wright told KBCW that every employee and their spouse are eligible for the bonus if they can show proof of vaccination. The county will use different funding sources for the bonus. Deputy County Manager Jenna Young said they're taking advantage of an opportunity offered by their health insurance carrier, Select Health. She said the idea arose out of discussions between County Manager Tom Fisher, Human Resources Director David Warnock, and Health Director Phil Bondurant. And she added several employees had suggested offering an incentive.
And in the process of that discussion, our HR director found out that Select Health was offering this program, and we would just have to opt into it. And so it's included on their end. So for folks who aren't vaccinated yet but are on our health plan, they just have to inform Select Health once they get their vaccination and they'll get the incentive.
However, Young said they were also concerned an inequity would exist for employees who had already done the right thing and gotten shots.
And so we decided, well, let's offer the same incentive for those employees, and then for those employees who also got vaccinated who aren't on our health plan, we wanted to cover them as well. And so I believe that $100 incentive that the county is providing for employees who are already vaccinated or those not on our health plan is being covered by a grant that the health department received. And then to the extent that they're not able to cover spouses because we added them later, the county is going on a premium holiday because our health insurance plan has performed so well the last couple of years. And so from that holiday, there'll be some money there to cover it as well.
Young said they can't disclose how many of their employees are unvaccinated due to medical privacy laws. She also said that under state law, the county cannot just order employees to be vaccinated, at least for the vaccines that have an emergency approval. Since Pfizer now has a full FDA approval, Young said they may require shots at some point, but for now, they choose to go with an incentive. For KBCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
Well, the Summit County Council held a regular meeting last night covering a wide range of issues. Joining me on the phone with a recap of everything on the agenda is Summit County Council Vice Chair Chris Robinson. Good morning, Chris.
Hi, Sean.
So let's jump right into it. The two 6 p.m. items were basically on one topic, the proposed $50 million open space general obligation bond. In total, about five members of the public spoke. Just about all were in favor. No one was strongly opposed, but a few people did have questions. We heard from three people from the Camas area, and they were concerned that if the bond passes, the funding isn't going to go towards the Camas Valley or the east side of the county as a whole. What can you say to address that concern?
I would say, first of all, that we can't categorically commit where the monies are going to be spent. It's countywide. The monies will be generated countywide. As I mentioned yesterday, I'm hopeful that the west side of the county, where most of the tax base is, and hence most of the proceeds will, from whence most of the proceeds will come, that they will embrace this. We have sought for a long time a mechanism to leverage local funds against state and federal funding for open space on the east side. And so I think we have a lot of intent there. I don't think it's realistic to say that no money will be spent on the west side, or that all of it will be spent on the east side. But I do think we need to come up with an equivalent or similar organization to the Basin Open Space Advisory Committee that would help inform the council on various open space projects across the whole county. We don't really have that mechanism. I think that's one of the next things we need to do.
Right. And next week you will have a hearing in the Snyderville Basin, but there was some discussion about having a hearing in Camas as well. Do you favor that?
Yes, I think it'd be terrific. We'd like as much input on it as possible, and we want people to hopefully understand it well so that they can make an informed decision when it comes time to vote on it.
Right. And can we talk a little bit about properties that are a little controversial because they maybe been proposed for development? A member of the public asked about eminent domain, about taking land for public purposes, but would you favor using this bond money to negotiate to try to acquire property like Park City did with Treasure Hill?
Oh, that's pretty common. It would be only on a willing seller, willing buyer basis. There's no threat of eminent domain. I believe we're forbidden from using it if it's not specifically outlined in the enabling language that gets voted upon. But certainly, there's sort of two alternatives in the end. The highest and best use for much of land is development. It's, we say pavement's the last crop. And then, so by providing a funding mechanism so that there is an alternative, so that in order for landowners who have their retirement or their inheritance tied up in their land, and the only way to realize the value is to sell it for development, this provides another mechanism.
And
we've done that many places. Mm-hmm. Some of our critics have said, well, we're taking land off. We've got high-priced real estate. People need places to live, why would we want to shorten, diminish the supply? That's the flip side of it.
And Deputy County Attorney Dave Thomas said the council does have the power to actually drop the bond proposal even when it's on the ballot and even if it is approved by the voters. Is that right?
Yeah, I think what the ballot measure is, it's authorizing us. It's not requiring us. It's authorizing us to issue, it would if we go all the way, to issue up to $50 million in these open space bonds. but it's not requiring it. If for some reason we felt like that a lesser dollar amount were appropriate, or that conditions had changed, maybe interest rates are unfavorable, or that there's been some kind of a big shock to the system that makes it imprudent, then we could back away.
And the council also held a discussion about the Resilience Fund project to help watershed areas cope with wildfire. Chris, how much money is Summit County being asked to contribute here? I think we heard $2 million thrown around several times last night. Do you know that exact dollar amount yet?
No. I mean, the idea is to create a fund that would have proceeds from many different parties that would then be used to basically better manage the Weber River watershed, which we heard was some 74,000 acres, not all of which is in our county. And we had some discussions about whether some areas that drain to the Weber through East Canyon Creek should be included and whatnot. But it's pretty early. I like the concept. I think everyone kind of likes the concept, everyone on the council, but the details are sketchy at this point.
And speaking of some of those details, two programs were mentioned in the meeting, capital projects that could cost tens of millions of dollars and an endowment fund of about $10 million for maintenance afterwards. Would the county be contributing money to both of those funds or just one?
Oh, I think it's to be determined. You know, I'm a little concerned about thinking that the proceeds or the earnings on a $10 million endowment would go to much. You know, with the current low fixed rates of return that you'd get on secure investments or relatively conservative investments, it wouldn't generate much every year. So those are all details, though.
Right. And there are some several options were discussed for raising these funds. One, a resilience fee, like a trash fee. You said you don't favor that. Why not?
I think that it, I said it's, excuse me, I have a little problem with my throat. I said that it's regressive, meaning that it hurts those low income or that are barely getting by the same as it does the wealthy. I think that's more suitable when we're having a charging for a dumpster to pick up your trash. But I think there are other methods that would be more equitable and better, such as the one that was discussed was one of the other ones that was discussed was to just have a special levy for it in the general fund on the property tax that would hit, you know, everybody pro rata based on their ad valorem tax or the values of their properties.
Right. And speaking of that tax increase, will that be discussed at the Truth in Taxation hearing on the 13th, October 13th?
Well, that was another concern was, we decided a few years ago that we were going to periodically review whether we should raise taxes instead of going for 20 years and then having these humongous increases like we've done in the past. And so this is a year when the county manager wanted to open a discussion on having truth in taxation. And so we asked, well, if it weren't for this resilience fund, is the manager proposing other potential tax increases? And the assistant manager said yes. And so we need to see what those are and see them in the context. And I was thinking that the best way to fund this would be to convince the Weber Basin Water Conservancy District that has a levy across the five counties that it composes, of which it is composed, and that they take a much more aggressive role in this, their watershed. But if it's just the county going it alone, then we need to view any tax increase in the context of what else is going on.
And you were also told that County Manager Tom Fisher may propose increasing taxes for other reasons. How does that factor into to your decision making?
Well, we got to see what those other reasons are. If you know, this GO bond is going to increase taxes slightly, and we need to see what the rest is. That's why I think we need to push a pause on that until the 13th of October, when we see what the manager has in mind.
And that third funding option was a building permit fee for residential buildings. What's your opinion on that, real quick?
I don't think that's a proper nexus to just put a burden on new construction to fund the forest resiliency. That leaves the rest of us that already here with getting off the hook without any impact.
And this resilience project is supposed to help a watershed that supplies the whole Wasatch Front as well. Should other counties contribute to this funding, you think?
Well, yeah, that's why I think that's right. And that's why I suggested that Weber Basin should take it up more seriously, because they already have it levy across all of those counties.
And there was also discussion on the Housing and Transit Reinvestment Zone, again, the concept okayed by recent legislation to foster mixed and affordable income housing around transit centers. But council members worked on understanding the details. There were items that were unclear, and a consultant said the law is probably going to be tweaked in several areas in the next legislative session. Do you know if you want the county to get involved in this yet, Chris?
I'm optimistic, I'm hopeful that it will be a tool. I don't understand it well enough yet to say whether it will be, and it may need some clarification, as you mentioned, before it will be an effective tool. But the ability to create a zone that would have a tax increment that would prioritize the project in UDOT's world, you know, so that we get 224 improved along the lines of the alternative analysis that we've received, I think would be very powerful. But whether or not it can do that and how it exactly works is yet to be determined, because it's a very new program. We would be the first applicant and it requires a little pioneering.
Gotcha. Anything else you would like to add before we let you go, Chris?
Well, I had heard that Rick Bruff may be retiring, and I'm sorry to hear that. He's been a great reporter, so hopefully that's not too imminent. But other than that, no, Sean, thank you.
All right, Chris, thank you so much. And we all share that sentiment for Rick Bruff. Chris Robinson with the Summit County Council, thank you so much for your time this morning.
You're welcome. Bye.
Well, by now, many of us have seen the movie Forrest Gump, you know, where the main character just keeps running and running and running. Jordan Moon is 33 years old and spent the last year right here in Park City training to break the 2016 world record for running across America in 42 days or less. He began his effort earlier this month and is making his way through Utah right now. Jordan joins me from the road right now. Jordan, good morning, and thank you for making some time for us this morning.
Good morning, Sean. Thank you so much for having me on. I really do appreciate it.
So I understand you are making your way from Duchesne to Vernal. How has the running been going this morning?
Well, the running this morning has been going well. We had a lot of commuters and semis, you know, traveling through Duchesne here on Highway 40. I just stopped at mile 10 to take a shoe and sock change break, as well as to talk to y'all. It's been a beautiful morning. Temperatures are great. Sunrise was absolutely beautiful. And we're going to have a great day today, work our way toward Vernal, and then, you know, eventually head to the dinosaur state line in Colorado. So it's been a great trip so far. I'm happy to be through and out of the Wasatch Mountains. It took us about 2 days to go through the entire mountains starting in Spanish Fork. And so the first day through the Wasatch was a big climb, and then yesterday was a huge descent down Indian Canyon into Duchesne. But everything is going great on the trip. Some days we've had lower mileage due to climbing, and we're looking to make up and push some big days when we get closer kind of toward the plains and the Midwest once we get out of Fort Collins, Colorado.
Sounds like a full day ahead of you. So you started this journey on September 2nd from the San Francisco City Hall, and your plan is to arrive at New York City's City Hall in less than 42 days. If you had to put a feeling on it right now, how are you feeling, and do you think that is achievable?
That's never coming out of my sights, so it's definitely achievable. There's going to have to be some longer days when we have lower elevation and flatter terrain. What really I was not expecting, the Sierra Nevadas were very difficult, steep grades, big climbs. So that took time out of the day for us with, our average pace. But I'm not counting anything out. I have a huge goal. I'm going for it. I've got a great team. I've got unbelievable support through friends, family, the community, as well as people that are meeting us along the trip. We are meeting locals in these small towns that are coming out and helping and cheering us on and delivering groceries and surprising us with cinnamon rolls and treat. Like it's been awesome. So we're keeping to our goal, and we're also doing as much as we can to help raise awareness and raise money for the American Brain Foundation. On my website, you can actually go straight to the donation page to the American Brain Foundation and donate toward the foundation, or there's a GoFundMe that donate straight to the team helping us with crossing the country. And we've had an amazing outcome so far from people pouring in and just wanting to help out.
Sounds like you have quite the support crew with you. I want to talk a little bit more about your reasons for running. Why the American Brain Foundation in particular and brain disease research? Why are you running for that?
Yes, sir. So when I fully devoted everything into this goal about a year and a half ago, I moved from Georgia to Park City, Utah to live and train. And it was absolutely an unbelievable experience living in Park City, and I'll be back after my run. But I had chose the American Brain Foundation. I reached out to them because my grandfather, I have been severely affected in my family through brain disease. My biggest mentor is my dad's father. My grandfather passed away a few years ago after he had a stroke, which changed his life completely. And right now, my grandmother is battling with dementia, and that is affecting my family on a daily basis. And as well, my uncle passed away from brain cancer. So brain disease affects one out of every six humans. So when I was thinking about this run, I was like, if there's anything I can do with this goal I have to help others, I'm going to do so. And so I reached out to the American Brain Foundation. They're located out of Minneapolis, Minnesota, and got a hold of them immediately. They were blown away with what I was doing, what I was attempting, and how I wanted to help them with raising money for research. And once we had a couple conversations, they helped me set up a donation page to where anybody who wants to help out or with me bringing attention to the foundation, can make that donation. And, you know, when I hit my low points on my run, I sit there and I think about family members. I think about people who are struggling in life. Every single day is different on this trip. I've hit extremely high highs and very low lows. And whenever I hit those lows, I start thinking about others. I have an unbelievable opportunity right now. I have amazing support. I'm healthy. I'm strong. I'm living. I'm here. I'm present. And, you know, there are people who are struggling daily. There are people who can't walk, who can't see their loved ones, who can't get out of bed. And I am just fortunate to be able to move my body, to push hard, to continue to achieve my goal. And, you know, I'm going to give it everything I got every single day. And that's what I told my crew about a week ago. I looked at them and I said, no matter what happens, I'm going to leave it all out every single day on the road. Whatever, if we get 35 miles, which has been our lowest when we had one of the biggest climbs, or whether it's 72, the average I need. So whatever day and whatever happens, we've already been through extreme weather. We had rain in the desert. We've had dust storms. We've had to switch schedule to running at night due to extreme temperatures during the day in Nevada. So whatever happens, we're ready for it. And we've got two more big climbs left on this trip. We've got to summit Rabbit Ears Pass and Steamboat Springs, and we also have to summit Cameron Pass outside of Walden and Fort Collins, and then we go down the Poudre Canyon to Fort Collins. I went to school at CSU, and my two crew members that are with me, they live in Fort Collins. So that's going to be a huge milestone, a huge morale booster to see friends and family in Fort Collins. And then we're going to push through the plains. And that's where I'm looking to make up any time that I lost through these climbs and through these passes in California, Nevada, and Utah, and then the upcoming Colorado. I'm looking to make it up through the plains. And we've got people, family members, friends that are going to be helping out through the rest of the state, as well as the country. And you know, every time I see a new face, it really, really brightens me up. Like as yesterday, we were coming through Indian Canyon, and one of my good friends found us in the canyon. We had no cell phone service all day, and he delivered a care package from Ken and Lucy Block. They gave us Hoonigan apparel, sweatshirts, hats, t-shirts, as well as stuff from Luna's Kitchen in Park City. They brought us a ton of food, pastries, cookies, everything that you could think of, as well as snacks. And you know, when somebody does something like that and goes out of their way to come help you, if you're in a low spot, which I was hurting yesterday, my left knee was killing me. Every day, stuff's hurting every single day. But yesterday was my left knee, and I was stopped changing my shoes, and my buddy Clay pulled up. And that was a huge morale booster, and so I pushed it hard the rest of the day into Duchesne. So just having little support, the little small things, go a long way.
I certainly bet they do. I want to talk to you really quick about your time training here in Park City before we have to let you go.
Okay.
Why did you choose Park City, and how do you actually train for a cross-country run?
All right, so I had chose Park City. There's a few states or a few cities that I was thinking of. I was thinking of a Boulder. I was thinking of Flagstaff, Leadville, Mammoth Lakes, and Park City was on the radar. My stepbrother lives in Park City, and he's been there for 5 years. And I came out 1/4 of July and visited. And when I saw the town, the infrastructure, how they have the trail systems, how the rail trail and, you know, the concrete asphalt trails to Kimball all the way to Park City, everything was designed perfectly. So I lived in Trailside. I lived in a house in Trailside. So right out my back door, I could hit Round Valley. I could go out in the front door and get on the rail trail system. And so I could go anywhere I wanted in the entire town on foot. If I felt like hitting, dirt roads, I'd hit dirt roads. If I wanted to go climb, the Wasatch Crest Trail, I'd run up Guardsman's, start at Snow Park at Deer Valley and work my way up to Guardsman's and then work my way to Jupiter over towards Square Top and, descend down into the canyons or descend down into Pine Brook. That was one of my favorite trails, the Wasatch Crest Trail, just because you're at such a high elevation. And, elevation's key. Yesterday I was running the entire day was above 7,500 feet until we descended down into Duchesne. So I'd say 90% we were at high elevation. That was the key moving to Park City. Elevation, the town, the people, everyone is pretty much like-minded. Everyone in Park City is so nice. They love the outdoors. They like being active. And I met a lot of great people through that. So, really, the training was train in the morning, go to work, get done with work, train in the afternoon, evening. So it was 2 days every single day. If there was something I would do differently after knowing what I know now, 21 days into our journey, I probably would have power hiked a lot more, even though I did take my dog on hikes every single day. But there has been a lot of climbing. There has been a lot of elevation gain. We're already at, in 21 days, we're at 51,000 feet of elevation gain. So normally some people don't even do that in a single year. So we've done that in 21 days. So it's just a lot of climbing. That's something I probably would have changed a little differently. But my body has adapted. I did some things on day three that I probably shouldn't have done. I took too much salt when it was 99 degrees, and my body started retaining all my water weight. So everything that I was drinking, it was thinking that I was overheating, that I was going into heat exhaustion, you know, retain all the water that you possibly can. And I was taking too much sodium, and I gained 12 pounds of water weight, and I blew up my knees, my ankles, everything swelled up huge. And it took some time for that swelling to go down. So that was a huge learning lesson. I was going through such a hot day. I was losing so many fluids. I'd wipe my forehead and I could feel the salt on my forehead. So I was like, man, I'm losing so much salt. I need more salt. When in hindsight, I didn't. And so just like little things I'm learning. But we have adapted the body. Every single night I get home, I do icing, cold plunge. I do massage. I do leg compression in my leg compression boots. And then I try to get 8 hours of sleep. In the beginning, we were getting five and a half hours of sleep. And the biggest thing in recovery is sleep. So we adjusted our schedule to where I was getting between 7 and 8 hours. And the body has really adapted to the mileage, as long as I'm getting my sleep. That is what I've realized.
That sounds incredible. Jordan, I know you're a very busy guy and you got to get back on the road really soon, but real quick, how can people follow your journey if they're interested, and where can they find you?
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for asking that. You can find me on my webpage at theamericanrunner.com. I have a link that has a live Garmin tracker, so you can see the speed that I'm traveling at, where we are in real time. It pings every 10 minutes, so, you know, usually every mile, it will ping where my location is, and that will be on. That's on until we stop at the end of the day and we stop the tracking. You can also find just stories and updates on my Instagram, which is The American Runner, or on my Facebook, which is Jordan Moon. And my crew is doing updates daily. And anybody who wants to follow along and see the journey can check us out.
Well, Jordan, thank you so much for carving some time out on your morning for us today. Best of luck today and the rest of your journey.
Sean, I really do appreciate you, and look forward to seeing you when I get back to Park City.
Absolutely. We'll see you here. All right. Bye-bye. Well, the added stress of a global pandemic has taken its toll on many people over the last year and a half. It would be good for many people to just relax. Parkite Rebecca Brenner will be teaching a six-week mindful relaxation course at the Park City Hospital's Live Well Center starting in October. She joins me on the phone right now to talk about the class and what mindful relaxation is. Rebecca, good morning, and thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me, Sean. It's good to be here.
So let's start with mindful relaxation. I think people are familiar with putting their feet up on the couch, turning on their favorite Netflix show, and taking a breather. But what's the difference between that and mindful relaxation?
That's a great question. Well, putting your feet up on the couch and watching your favorite Netflix show is good self-care, right? That's important to do. Sometimes it's important to kind of check out, which is what I would call that, right? When we kind of get on our phone, our favorite apps, watch or binge our favorite TV shows, that's a great way to kind of check out when we're feeling overwhelmed or just stressed out or just need some time. Mindful relaxation is different because it's a way of really checking in. We get more present and we start to pay attention to what's actually happening in our mind-body system. And then we work with that to start to release and relax and open the ways that we're holding or bracing in our bodies, in our minds, in our hearts.
And I mentioned in my introduction that this COVID-19 pandemic has kind of touched every facet of daily life, and it has added so much more stress to people's lives than not that long ago. Can you talk about the need for this kind of mindful relaxation now, and how has that need increased in your eyes?
Yeah, well, when the pandemic first began, like everybody, I was feeling, you know, stressed out, concerned, worried, overwhelmed at times. And my own mindful practice really shifted to relaxation, ways that I could start to deeply relax my own nervous system and my own body so that I could be more present for my family, for my community, for myself in challenging times, and not sort of get overwhelmed in that momentum of overwhelm that can add to the stress of yourself, your family, your community, the world at large. And I had students start to reach out to me and say, hey, are you going to teach any classes online during the pandemic? And I thought, well, what could I offer in this time that would be beneficial? Because there were so many Zoom classes, so many things happening, that started to feel overwhelming for people. And so I did. I created a relaxation course that was a mindfulness course, but really focused on deep practices, actual practices on regulating the nervous system and body. And it was a joy to teach. I received great feedback. And then when the world started to open up a little bit more, the Live Well Center reached out and asked if I would want to teach the course at the hospital. And I agreed. I thought it was a great place and a great idea. And so I think in times where, especially the last couple of years, there has been so many things and necessary things that have been coming up and that have been stressful, and the overwhelm and all the information and all the online living. And that is important to pay attention to. And meanwhile, it's also really, really important to know how to unplug from that and to check in with your own body, your own mind, your own heart, and to make sure that it's not taxed and overwhelmed so that you can be a beneficial member of your family, of your community, of the world at large.
Yeah, unplugging is always important. Thinking back on your own journey for mindful relaxation, what part of it was the hardest for you to master? And how do you help people overcome some of those obstacles in your course?
Well, I think the main thing is, I mean, how we started this discussion this morning, you know, we all think that we have an idea of what relaxation is, right? We're like, oh yeah, I know what relaxation is. I just have to get off my phone or put my feet up or just chill out, right? Or yeah, I have this thing on my app that tells me to breathe for a minute and I do that. That's the difference is with a practice is that it's not conceptual. It's not an idea in our head that we understand intellectually how to relax. Relaxation is really a physical, visceral, somatic practice. So we have to come out of our thinking mind and our thoughts and our ideas around what we think it means to relax, and then start to really experience in our own systems what tension is, where we're holding tension in the body, how we're bracing, how we're gripping, and then start to learn how to release that in our own bodies and feel the sensation of our bodies starting to downshift. And then to have the experience at the end of, say, a two-hour class of learning how to do that, to then have that experience of, this is what my body feels like when it's relaxed. And this is how my mind and my heart, my emotional body reflect that feeling and these sensations of relaxation. So it's a little jump, but it's a big jump that we have to make when we come into actually practicing relaxation.
So let's talk a little bit about this course in particular. It starts on October 7th, runs through the first part of November. How will it be structured? How is this kind of a slow introduction to mindful relaxation, or are you going to be jumping in right away?
Yeah, so, yep, the class is October 7th through November 11th, and it's Thursday evenings from 6 until 8 p.m. And the Live Well Center is also offering it as a hybrid, so you can do it in person. You can do all the classes in person at the Live Well Center. You can do all the classes online. We'll have an online option, or you can do kind of a mix of that, depending on what your schedule is like and what you need. And the class itself is going to be not a ton of talking or me sort of up there lecturing, again, sort of intellectually what mindfulness is and why we need to relax more. It's really going to be sort of right from the beginning, getting into these practices, closing our eyes, laying down on our mats, and beginning to cultivate the sensations of a relaxed body, relaxed breathing, right from the beginning.
And how can people get more information on this course, sign up?
So the Live Well Center, there's you can go to intermountainhealthcare.org/calendar and just search mindful relaxation. You can also call the Live Well Center, 435-333-3535 if you have any questions. And if anybody had any more questions for me, they're welcome to email me at RebeccaSBrenner@gmail.com, and I'm happy to answer any questions via email.
And is there a fee to register for this course?
Yes, the course for the 6 weeks is $150.
Gotcha. And how much interest have you cultivated already? How booked are you?
We're starting to fill up, yeah. So it would be great to have a full class, and again, just to give yourself the time to learn how to relax. And the other part of it is that not only will we be learning in the class how to relax and to really feel that, but then ways that we can take that into our everyday life. So how does that then transpire into our relationships, our work? And relaxation isn't even just about sort of the stressful aspects of life, but it can deepen our quality of life, right? So to be able to bring that sort of deeper quality of presence and well-being into our everyday life as well.
Rebecca, anything else you want to share with us this morning?
No, thank you so much for having me, Sean.
All right, Rebecca, thank you so much for taking some time out of your morning. Rebecca Brenner will be teaching a 6-week mindful relaxation course at the Park City Hospital's Live Well Center starting October 7th, running through November 11th. Well, the Colville Planning Commission on Monday night got an introduction to Red Hills Ranch, a proposal of nearly 250 acres on the southern end of the city, with development rights going back 20 years. Rick Bruff has all the details.
The applicant, Ivory Development, is proposing 349 units of residential single-family units and townhomes. The land was annexed and rezoned by Colville in 2001 under an agreement with an investment company headed by ski industry icon Ian Cumming. The company still holds the land, but longtime Colville residents have always called it the Parley Brown property after a long-departed owner. The site is mostly open land to the east of Hoytsville Road, but on the south edge, a portion crosses the road and stretches out to Interstate 80. The planner for Red Hills, Eric Landvart, said the proposed development's design is sensitive to the land and includes more open space and trails than required by the code. He said nearly 60% of the project will be open space. Details also include a connection to the rail trail, a clubhouse, and a system of several parks. Colville's planner Don Sargent said the annexation agreement is also, to some extent, a development agreement. City Attorney Sheldon Smith told the planning commissioners their review will be limited.
One thing that to keep in mind is that the way it was approved back in 2001, when it was annexed, it basically makes it a permitted use at this point. So there isn't a whole lot of negotiation on density. I mean, obviously they're looking at the density bonus. We'll look at that very carefully to make sure that's calculated correctly. But other than that, it's what has been presented is what was put on the books. rights, some vested rights.
Planning Commissioner Julia Vernon had one suggestion for the applicants, but said she liked the plan and how it's designed around the landscape.
You guys, it looks like you've done a great job designing that around that. It looks like a great design to me. I love the parks that you've added, the extra space you've added. I think that'll be great for the residents there. I would encourage you to consider making the townhomes owner owned, just for the fact that we really do need some affordable housing. Everything there's kind of going out of sight. It would be nice to have some starter homes for people.
In response, Ivory Representative Skylar Tolbert noted that the annexation agreement did mention affordable housing. The Planning Commission said that Red Hills should proceed to the preliminary plan approval stage and come back for another work session. On another item, Planning Commissioners had little comment about an introduction to the Wohowee Phase 2 preliminary plan. Don Sargent noted they've had many previous meetings on the overall project, which will be located in the hills west of Interstate 80. Phase 2 includes an 11-hole golf course and 181 resort units that are basically nightly rentals. Sargent said the Planning Commission took note also of 32 golf lodge house units in Phase 2 and asked for details from the applicants.
That's one thing I'm going to get a little more detail on before the next meeting, just how those are configured within those structures.
Colville City Planner Don Sargent, he said the next meeting will be a continued work session and a public hearing. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.